Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 5, delivered on September 3, 2014. The title of this lecture is The Tools of Monetary Policy.
Today, the tools of monetary policy. I'm a little behind on the lectures, and I'll catch up one of these days. But this is a technical lecture. But it ends with something that might be worth your while to live through the technical part. Yeah, it'll get up there. It's not even showing yet, is it? That zero is just, that quiz zero, there's something about it. I think it's possessed. I might actually have to delete quiz zero and recreate it for that. But you'll have a, but I'm glad you brought that up. There will be a quiz up for the weekend for you to do. It's a review quiz, so make sure you bring out your notes for doing it, because it's some of it's old material, but I'm just kind of doing a review to catch you up to the present. And then next week I'll do a quiz that's more on the Federal Reserve. So keep an eye on what I'm doing here. Like I said, in the last lecture, the Federal Reserve has three different jobs. One of those jobs is to be a regulator of banks. Its second job is as a bank for banks, competing directly against private providers, private banks that do banking services for banks. And the third one is that the Fed conducts monetary policy. Now, it looks like pretty much all of you saw that little video that the Fed publishes, cheesy as it is, and we're going to key on that third part of monetary policy. Now, remember that the Fed has seven governors appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the president, of the Senate. And it has 12 district bank presidents. Now, the seven governors are powerful. The 12 district bank presidents are also quite powerful, too. Now, you take the seven governors who have permanent seats on this committee that I'm going to talk about, and you have five district bank presidents. That serve on this committee, too, on a rotating basis. And those are 12 people constitute the members of the Federal Open Market Committee, the voting members. Now, four of these five serve two-year rotating terms. Every year, a couple of them have done their 2 years, and then they're replaced by two other bank presidents, district bank presidents. Four of them. There is one of these who serves on a permanent seat. That permanent seat is held by the bank president of the Federal Bank of New York. That's called the Empire Bank. It is a special bank. I'll explain why in a while. So, the Federal Open Market Committee, a powerful organization that is the subject of many conspiracy theories. The Federal Reserve is the subject of all kinds of wonderful conspiracy theories. It controls the world. It's controlled by communists, by Jewish interests, by Freemasons, whatever, one way or the other. One way or the other, it is a powerful organization, the Fed is, and the Federal Open Market Committee has extraordinary power over the economy, especially in the short run. Again, the FOMC has the seven governors who vote as permanent members, 5 district bank presidents. One of those is a permanent voting member, the president of the New York Bank, the Empire Bank. And then 4 of them serve on 4-year rotating terms. The chairman, of course, sort of is a spokesman for the whole group, but you'll have different opinions at any given time among the governors and the bank presidents who are voting. Some of them are the kind who say, we've got, like right now, some of them say the economy is still struggling, we still have to have an expansionary monetary policy to keep the economy, helping the economy. Some of them say it is time, past time, for us to stop pouring money into the economy. All we're doing is buying ourselves inflation down the road. Sooner or later, all of this excess liquidity is going to come back to bite us in the ass. And so those are what we call inflation hawks. They are still in the minority on the Federal Reserve in the FOMC. But they are getting louder and louder, saying, first of all this money we're pouring into the economy, it's not helping. This quantitative easing, 1. Quantitative easing, 2. That's a fancy word for shoveling money into the economy. It's not doing any good. All it's doing is feeding money to the banks, and the banks, instead of pouring that money into the economy, are just throwing it at investments that's driving the stock market up. But it can't last forever. Sooner or later, that liquidity overhang is going to spread, and we're going to have hellacious inflation as a result of that. Just like the kind we had in the 70s that finally had to be stopped with really hardcore contractionary monetary policy. All that aside, let's talk about how the Fed can move the money supply. How does it make it go up and make it go down? The first tool is a blunt tool. It's like a meat axe. It's one that probably wouldn't be used too often. But it works like this, and we'll call this the monetary policy. The first tool is the required reserve ratio. Sometimes you'll hear me actually, there's an older term for it, the fractional reserve ratio. I'm not sure when it stopped being called the fractional reserve ratio, but one way or the other, it works like this. Look, a bank takes in money. The way it makes money off the money that it takes in is to lend it back out and collect interest on the money it lends out. Now, it would be great if I deposited $100 in your bank and you just lent $100 to this guy. But then when he came back in to get some of his money, or when someone else came in to get some money, yeah, you would essentially collapse right there because you didn't have the money. So we have a requirement that the bank keep a fraction of the money that is deposited. So we'll go through an exercise here. It turns out that you're walking down the street one day, and a $100 bill falls out of the sky. It just lands in front of you. Well, now you pick it up, and you say, "Bwahaha, cheeseburgers, bwahaha." Maybe a girlfriend, things like that, for half an hour. So, but then you realize, okay, I can't do this. I gotta save money. You know, someday I'm going to need money for that house trailer I want. So, you go to the bank. And the bank, you put the $100 in there. Now, I am your banker. Now, I have to keep some of the money in case you want some of it back. So let's say that my reserve ratio is 20%. So I'm going to put $20 in the vault. But Now I've got $80, and you come into my bank and you say, sir, I have a new business idea and I need to borrow $80. What's your business idea? I'm going to start my own massage service. I'm changing my name to Sven, and I'm having silicone pumped into my biceps and my abs so that I ripple, and I'm going to be a masseur for lonely people. And I'm going to call it Sven's Massage Service. So you are actually a contractor who builds massage service buildings. And so, okay, I'm going to lend you $80. So you pay this fine construction artiste to build your massage parlor. And you get your business going, stimulates the economy, of course, and you have $80. Now you take it to my bank and you deposit it. Well, I have to keep 20% of that, so I put $16 in. Oh, let me put the available. First was 80. And now, out of this, I have $64 to lend. And you show up at my bank. I have a business idea and I need to borrow $64. Well, what's your business idea? Pies. Pies? Yes, pies. What kind of pies? Pies made with love. Pies made with love? Yes, that's the name of my business. Apple pies and Dutch apple. Oh my God, here's $64. So I give you $64 to start your business and you hire this woman to do make up your pie kitchen and your pie plate, buy your pie plates and your pie display. And you've got $64 and so in your pocket, so you take it to the bank and deposit it. So I have $64 now on the books, and I'm going to have to keep 20% of that, which is $12.80. And that means that I will have $51.20 to lend. And you show up at my bank. I need to borrow money. For what? For a new business that caters parties. How does it cater parties? Explosives. Sweet. Are we talking like real explosives? Oh, yeah, yeah. C4. For old-fashioned people, dynamite. The kids love it. In the cake, light the cake. Boy, watch that kid blow out those candles fast. Uh-huh. Okay. I lend you $51.20, and you pay him. He has explosives. Not necessarily legal, but, he has explosives. And so he gets the $51, and he puts that in the bank. $51.20. I want you to notice what's going on. The money supply is growing. A $100 bill that started this whole thing has 180, 206, 244, for God's sake, $295.20. Do you see that the money supply on the books of the bank, there is more money than there was. And as long as this keeps going, the money supply will grow. Eventually, the actual amount of money created by the $100 deposit, it will turn out to be, and this is a simplified formula, it doesn't take into account that they might keep some money in their pocket, but for our purposes, it's fine. The growth, the change in the money supply, delta M, will be the original deposit times 1 over the required reserve ratio. Now that 1 over RRR is called the money multiplier. In this case, it would be 1 over 0.20, which is 5. So the money multiplier in this world that I've created is 5. And you take that times the initial deposit, which was $100, And you will find out that the money supply actually expanded by $500 with just a $100 deposit. Now, if the fractional reserve ratio had been, let's say, the RRR, so RRR at 20% makes the money multiplier, what was it, 10, right? Yeah. If the required reserve ratio had been 10%, no, wait a minute.
Five,
I can do that. Get off me. God, I so suck at math, and I taught math for years. I've really wrecked a lot of kids. So as I reduce the money multiplier, the required reserve ratio, which is set by the Fed, the money multiplier goes upward. It's a blunt tool. Now, generally speaking, this required reserve ratio, its primary use for the Fed would be to control as sort of a way of recognizing how confident people are in the banking system. So if I'm in a world where I think people might really run their banks, I'd probably make this required reserve ratio very high so that the banks would have plenty of money for people who came in to get their money out. But if I'm in a world where I think people are very confident about banks, they're not worried about going to their banks and getting their money out, worrying about the economy or something, the required reserve ratio would be pretty low in a case like that. So it would be more like the required reserve ratio would be set and changed based upon the Fed's reading of the confidence in the banking system. Well, this is a real number. This is something the Fed sets. And the oddest thing is that it was actually not that many years ago, probably about 5 years ago, someone asked me in one of these classes, well, what is the required reserve ratio right now? And I taught this for years, and I didn't know. I thought, well, I'll get back to you on that because it's actually kind of interesting. I would like to see what it is. So I called a fellow I know down at the St. Louis Fed, and I said, what's the required reserve ratio? And he said, well, that's kind of a basic question. I said, yeah, I know, right? I'm an economist, and I don't know what it is. And he said, well, the answer isn't so basic. He said, there is not one required reserve ratio. I thought, wait, what? You mean I've been teaching it wrong all these years? He said, oh, it's okay if you teach it that way. He said, but in the real world, we actually have three different required reserve ratios. I said, well, how does this work? He said, okay, for the first $10 million tranche of money in a bank, we have one reserve ratio. For the next, I can't remember what he said, like 50 million or something like that, we have another required reserve ratio. And for all the money in a bank after that, we have even another required reserve ratio. So in other words, like real small banks would have one ratio, bigger banks, their marginal ratio would be higher, and the super big banks, their marginal ratio would be higher than that. I said, okay. Give them to me. He said, well, there's a website where they are, but I'll tell them to you if you're too lazy. You know, bite me. Tell me. And he said, okay, the first $10 million tranche of money in a bank has a required reserve ratio of zero. And then he said, now the next, and I said, stop right there. Wait, what? You're telling me that the required reserve ratio for the first $10 million in any bank in the United States is zero? They don't have to keep any of it in the vault? He said, that's right. I said, well, that's wrong. And he said, what's wrong with it? He said, this allows banks that are smaller to be able to use all of the money that's deposited to lend out so they can make interest on it so that they can build, make loans. He said, because these are probably small banks, community banks, things like that, where we want to encourage them as much as possible to make loans in the community. What better way to do that than to tell them they don't have to have any money in the vault? I said, well, what do they do if someone comes in and wants money? Well, he said, they're not going to be stupid. They'll keep money, but they're not required to. He said, technically, maybe not. Maybe not. So that was a little bit of an eye-opener to me, that the required reserve ratio, if you think about that, the money multiplier from that would be infinite because you have 1/0. And you know what happens when you do that. A black hole opens and everything in the universe is sucked in. And all. But that's how it works. And then the one above that, I can't remember what the numbers were then, but they were not very large numbers. And the reason for that was that they were trying to grow the money supply through the fractional reserve ratio. And I said, so in other words, low ratios like you've got now, they are indicating that you're not afraid that banks are going to have a run on them. He said, we're not really afraid of that anymore. Like in the old days, if a bank couldn't satisfy one depositor, a depositor comes in, I need some of my money back, and they didn't have it in the vault, he'd be out there screaming, and everyone would run that bank. And, of course, that would then make the bank really collapse because they wouldn't have the money for everyone who was freaking out. And then people would start running banks around that bank, and they'd fall apart. And he said, well, we really don't worry about that so much anymore. I said, well, that was what that nearly destroyed the U.S. economy over and over again in the 1800s and in the early 1900s. You even saw it, they mentioned in that stupid cartoon video. He said, yeah, well, our regulators are watching these small banks so closely now that it would be highly unlikely that any of them would get into a situation where they would go into illiquidity on deposit demands. So that's their logic behind, you know, keeping it so zero. Anyway, and he said, besides, we can provide liquidity so much faster anymore because money is essentially electronic. He said if a bank is in that kind of trouble, we can have trucks there within 30 minutes with money. So, you know, it's the concept of a run on a bank isn't all that likely in their judgment, so they can have low required reserve ratios. Now, right after 9/11, my understanding is that they threw the reserve ratios up pretty darn high, very quickly, because they thought that after the towers had been hit, people were going to freak and they were going to run to their banks and pull all their money out and all that kind of stuff. So they popped it because in that time, they thought people were going to freak and just try to get all their money out of banks and hide in their homes, bury it in their under their houses and stuff like that. But anyway, enough of that. Blunt tool, not used very often. Second tool. The discount rate. Any bank can go up to the Fed and walk up to what is hypothetically, it kind of exists, step up to the discount window and borrow money. If a bank is in trouble, it needs money, or it wants to just get more money to stimulate the economy, a bank can borrow from the Fed at the discount rate that the Fed sets. Historically, banks didn't like to do that. They would prefer to go to the interbank lending market to borrow from other banks. All banks have their money in this giant, this enormous pool that's called the federal funds market. That's where all the banks' money is. Now, this federal funds market, in that Fed funds market, the money in there, let me put this way, lendable funds is the horizontal axis, And there is an interest rate in this market driven by the supply of and demand for money, for lendable funds. There is a demand for the money and there's a supply of the money in this market. And that's the Fed funds market. And at any given time, there's an equilibrium price, which we call the federal funds rate or the Fed funds rate. Most banks used to go to that market. They would borrow from each other for money they needed. Interestingly, though, the Fed funds rate is higher than the discount rate. And the question is always kind of fun to ask, well, why would banks, when they could go to the Fed and get money at a low discount rate, would they prefer to borrow from each other in this open Fed funds market that where the rate is set by supply and demand conditions? The answer is actually kind of simple on a long-term basis. I hate to tell you this, son, but I'm your father. May God help me. It's because of your mother you look the way you do. But damn ugly she was. Shouldn't have been drinking that night. Listen. Shut up. You need $1,000. Real fast, real bad. Now, you've got friends who can lend that to you, or you can come to me and borrow it. Now, I'll lend it to you. I might even lend it to you free for a low, very low interest rate. Or you can borrow it from your friends, and they'll charge you a little higher interest rate. Why would you go to your friends for the money instead of coming to me? Now, I want to point one thing out. I'm an asshole. No, I really am. Now, keeping that in mind, you know I'm good for the money. I'll lend it to you. You know your friends will lend it to you. They'll lend it to you at a higher interest rate. I'll lend it to you at a lower interest rate. Why would you go to your friends instead of me?
Better relationship and trust.
Let's boil it down to this. They're not going to ask you questions and put you on a torture machine and waterboard your ass to find out why you need it before they give it to you. I will. I promise. I have got tasers that I've modified. I'll find out why you need that $1,000 so bad. You see, the Fed is like a dad. It's going to want to know things. It's going to keep records of things. That you go to the interbank lending market, it's just automatic. It's there. It's just this vast, giant global pool, a national pool. But if you come to my discount window, there I am. Hi. Why the hell do you need $1,000? Oh, my God, you got to leave the country. What did you do this time? You see, that's the deal. That's why you would see, historically, the Fed funds rate is always higher. Even though the Fed tries to play with this rate, it can't set it. It's set by supply and demand conditions. The best the Fed can do with the Fed funds rate is to try to move it by adding or draining liquidity from the federal funds market, but it can't set it. It can set the discount rate. Now, after the financial apocalypse started in 2008, the economy was spiraling into a death spin. The Fed dropped this rate hard and essentially just saying, please just come here. The Fed funds rate is still up there. But we're just going to basically, you know, a quarter of a point interest, 0% interest, whatever you need so that you've got money, so that you can lend money to people and businesses, come to the window, we'll do it, and we'll be nice about it. So, of course, banks, the huge, huge banks and smaller banks and mid-sized banks, they lined up for all this great money that was available at the discount window. It sort of broke that historical aversion to the discount window because, I mean, it was just sort of like, do you usually have this many banks lined up here? No, but now that we're giving away money almost for free and we're being nice about it, so the discount window was popular and still is.
because the discount rate is so low. Still, the discount rate is like a signal. As much as it was anything else, for a long time, it was just sort of like the Fed saying, this is where we want, this is what our intentions are for the economy. If we raise the discount rate, well, that means we want to slow it down. If we drop the discount rate, we want to speed it up. But in the more recent era, it was a signal still, but it was also a real thing the banks were using enormously. But here was the problem. The banks were borrowing the money at the discount window at incredibly low rates, vast sums of money, but they weren't lending it out. That was the only way we could stimulate the economy through this trick, was if the banks got the money and then they lent it out to businesses and people at low interest rates because they were getting it at low interest rates. The banks weren't doing that with the money. Instead, they were doing investments overseas, buying stocks, playing back, trying to step back into the world that had gotten them in so much trouble to begin with. The banks kept saying, well, there's a credit crisis. We really can't be lending people and businesses money because, you know, like they're all going bankrupt. So we really can't lend them money until this credit crisis is over. And essentially, us private economists were saying, bitch, it'll stay there until you start lending. But they weren't going to do it.
I'm sorry, who are those idiots that are running these banks?
They're very rich people, so see, that's just it. It was like, what do we have to do? Even the Fed, and I don't have this on authority, but even from the rumors I heard, the Fed people were calling these big, heavy banks. Why? You just borrowed $100 million from us. Why are you not lending any money to any businesses? Why aren't you lending money to people to buy cars? Well, we can't. Well, why can't you? Because people might default. Well, you know what? Yeah, welcome to the world. Your ass is covered. It's not going to kill you to do this. We got to get this economy moving. As a matter of fact, one business publication, Business Week it was, which a lot of, some business publications take this just always business, the most conservative right-wing business claims are always right. There's nothing else but what businesses say. Business Week tends to take a much more balanced perspective, and they did a very strong article about this credit crisis saying, this is just, at this point, here are the numbers. Here's how much is being lent. Here's what the Fed is doing. And yet these banks keep claiming credit crisis while the economy is still struggling. This recession is not going to get over with. We're not going to get underway for a recovery until these banks start lending money again. So what's going on? And the article was pretty darn nasty to the banks and the bank decision makers about their motives. You don't seem to have a problem with investing in these ridiculously high-risk securities overseas, pouring money into buy stocks and bonds and all that. You're driving the stock market up. You're feeding the wealthiest, most powerful interests in the world. And you're just letting the economy, the American economy, go to hell every time you do that. And the bank executives say, what are you going to do about it? You going to do anything? You going to punch me? They knew what they were doing. There was no power to stop them from doing it. And the Fed was a little too chicken to close down the discount window because it was like, well, if we close it down, then they're going to say that there's a liquidity crunch happening. So on that score, the Fed, for all the criticisms that I do of the Fed and all of that, and some of them are pretty scathing, there was a real serious problem. The discount window was wide open. Use me. Get money for almost free. And yet the banks were not. And that's why the recession just kept going. And we really, even to this day, we're sputtering in part because liquidity was being made available, but it just was not getting to where it would actually do something. You buy $100 million worth of stock in some IPO of Facebook. You know what you're doing? You are making pizza face Zuckerberg richer. That's what you're doing. You're not helping the economy. Enough of that. The third one is the heavy. Now, the discount rate is changed as it's signaling in its signaling capacity about 8 times a year at FOMC meetings. Now, understand also that at the FOMC meetings, they declare a target for the fractional reserve rate, I'm sorry, for the federal funds rate. They don't set it. And it's so fun when you hear these talking heads on the Financial News Network and read these business news articles. The Federal Open Market Committee met today and they set the federal funds rate at... No, they didn't. They can set the discount rate, and they do, at each of their 8 meetings. And they also can have some special meetings. But they can set a target for what they want the federal funds rate to be, but they can't set the rate itself. The only way that they can make the federal funds rate move toward a target they're setting is by moving the supply of lendable funds backward and forward. The way they do that, one way, of course, was by trying to get banks to borrow money, which would push money into the federal funds market, bring the federal funds rate down, and therefore all rates attached to it would go down too. And a lot of rates are tied to the federal funds rate. But there's another way they do it. It's a way, required reserve ratio, only rarely would that be moved around. The discount rate, maybe 8 times a year, but usually it's not even moved at their meetings. They just say, we leave the discount rate where it is. The next way, the last way, is used every day. It is constantly in motion, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars every day, and hardly anyone outside of business and economics, the worlds that we're in, knows that this is happening. These vast ocean waves of funds ebbing and flowing like tidal forces, and no one knows this is happening. It's called open market operations, OMOs. Now remember that the entire goal of open market operations is to move the supply of liquidity back and forth, to add liquidity to the markets, in other words, more money shows up in the markets, or drain liquidity, claw money back from the federal funds market. Also, as another result of these OMOs, not only are they affecting the federal funds rate, they're actually affecting government debt instrument rates as well. Now, the terminology I'm going to use is a little bit off, but it's essentially right. It's a little oversimplified, but then again, so am I. So I'm going to show you what's going on here. Banks have assets. They have different levels of liquidity in their assets. They have some assets that are actually highly illiquid. Chase Bank owns the Chase Tower. Well, that's a highly illiquid asset. But, of course, the bank would also have large time deposits that they have from, that they've put money into in huge, bigger banks. Those would be kind of illiquid, too. But they also have a level of highly liquid assets. Tier 1 assets. Highly liquid. Now they have two kinds of these. There are two basic kinds for the purposes of this. A bank has money, greenbacks, you know, dollar. Highly liquid, perfectly safe. Two things. That's tier one. But they have another tier one. Highly liquid, perfectly safe. It is almost a perfect substitute for dollars, but except for one defect in it. This other asset in tier one are T-bills. They are highly liquid and perfectly safe. The only thing about T-bills is that T-bills can't be used to lend. A bank can lend you money, but it can't lend you T-bills. So in other words, T-bills are high liquidity, but they are stuck in the bank. The dollars are highly liquid, and they can flow out of the bank in loans and satisfying checking demand checks and all that kind of stuff. This is the tier one portfolio of a bank. That's the tier one portfolio of a bank. Yeah. The only difference is that if a bank in its vault has a stack of money here and a stack of T-bills here, if you go in, I want to borrow some money, the bank would walk over to the stack of money and lend it to you. They could not go over and get, I mean, you'd say, what is this if they tried to give you the T-bills? So that's their only defect. They're perfectly safe. They're highly liquid. You can sell them anytime you want to brokers, but they can't go out to people. So they have that one tiny defect that makes them impossible for the bank to do anything with them. They just sit there. Now, let's take the Open Market Committee. It has one of its meetings. And they decide at this meeting that they are going to expand the money supply. They want to add liquidity to the market. This is the decision they've made. So, what happens from here is that the one permanent voting member who's a bank president is from the Empire Bank in New York. Now, why he's a permanent voting member is because the New York Fed is where the domestic trading desk is, the DTD. Now, I'm not talking about a desk like one you'd buy from Target or Souder, put together yourself, or IKEA. The desk here is a vast ocean of desks of traders, Fed traders. Each of them in this room, oh, it's not a room, but let me simplify. Each of them in this area has a portfolio of dollars and T-bills. The Fed prints the dollars, the Fed buys the T-bills from the Treasury at auctions. And how does it buy those from the Treasury at auction? It prints the dollars to do that. Anyway, so the Fed bank president sends the message to the domestic trading desk manager. The order is expand the money supply. The domestic trading desk manager then communicates this to the traders, all of these traders. Now you are a trader. You're a trader for the Fed. You have in your desk green and T. You have money and you have T-bills. You go to your file and you go to call a bank. Okay, I'm a bank president. Now remember, I'm a bank president. I'm going to sit there. I have dollars and I have T-bills. And I'm sitting there in my bank being a bank president looking very responsible. And I close the door even to fart and all that. And I'm just sitting there and your secretary says, and my secretary calls me on the phone. I'm the bank president. Ring, ring. Hello. Mr. Kring, we have a Fed desk trader on line two. Well, put him on the line. Ha, ha, ha. Now, your job is to add money to the banking system, to get money to flow into the federal funds market. You have something that you could trade for something I have. I have something you want. Okay? Now, what do you want me to have more of? Money. Green. What do I have that I could sell you? I have green and tea. So which one of them are you trying to buy from me? The teas. You see, if you can get me to buy a T-bill, that means that you can then deposit green into my account in the federal funds market. You following me so far? So your job is to talk me into giving up one of my T-bills. So go ahead. No. I mean, sell to me. Sell to me. I'm the bank president. You know? Oh, come on, you're a business. I mean, you're a handsome, upstanding young stud. Talk to me. Say, I'd like to sell you a T. I'd like to buy your T-bills. Go to hell. Not selling. I like my T-bills. Okay, so what are you going to do? Are you going to do to try to get me to buy your to get me to sell you my T-bills so you can give me money? What are you going to do? Offer me what as far as price goes? Offer me what kind of a price? Let's say that you originally said $950, and I said, go to hell. What are you going to do next to try to get me to sell you a T-bill? Go ahead. A thousand means there's no interest. Go ahead. Give a price. No, just give me a price.
$925?
You offered me $950, and I said, go to hell. You're going to take me down to $925? Bite me. You know? Choose some donkey sausage. No. Raise it. To what? No, well, you stop it with going over $1,000. It's only worth $1,000. $970, thank God. My God. I got to stop smoking if I'm going to work with you people. I mean, damn. $975. Thank God. No. $977, what do I look like? Do I look like I was born at night, but not last night? Work it, girl. $980? $995. Okay. Okay, you see what's happening is you, by all the demand that is coming in, traders are all over the place calling, we want T-bills, we want T-bills. That action is going to push the prices of T-bills upward. Okay, what happens when the price of a T-bill goes up? What happens to the yield on the T-bill? You remember that from the second lecture? Price goes up, yield goes down. So in other words, by all of this demand for T-bills flowing into the market, what is effectively happening is that you're driving the yields on T-bills down. In other words, you're forcing one of the key interest rates of the economy down. So in other words, through this action of yours, as far as the price of T-bills goes, by you at the Fed, and this is the real real interest rate. I'm sorry. Let me do this. Price of a T-bill. Price T-bill one. By all of this action at the Fed demanding T-bills from banks, they push the demand for T-bills outward, which drives the price of the T-bills upward, which means that the yield on the T-bills goes down. So they're pushing interest rates down. And finally I say, okay, fine, I'll sell you some T-bills. So you immediately, what happens is that I send T-bills over to you to put in your desk drawer, and those are no longer here. You send greenbacks over here and add liquidity to the federal funds market. So in other words, the supply of federal funds goes outward from S1 to S2, pushing the federal funds rate down. Two things have happened. You added liquidity to the economy by buying my T-bills from me, which pushed money into the lendable funds market, driving the Fed funds rate down. And at the same time, all that extra demand for T-bills from the traders is pushing the prices of T-bills upward, and therefore the yields on government debt instruments downward. And if the yield on government debt instruments goes down, then pretty much a lot of other interest rates in the economy will go down too. So that had, you had a double whack, a double impact. Now let's take it the other way. Suppose that they want to contract the money supply. So
Suppose we want to contract the money supply. Yeah, go ahead. So what has happened is I finally sold him some T-bills. So I mail him my T-bills, and he pushes a couple of buttons, and all of a sudden this extra money shows up in my bank account as a bank, but my bank account is here in the federal funds market. Now, if this is happening to thousands and thousands of banks all at the same time, banks are selling T-bills to the Fed. The Fed is paying for them by depositing electronically into the federal funds market. That's pushing the supply of lendable funds sitting in the federal funds market upward. That vast pool of money lifts up because all these traders are paying for their T-bills and putting the money into the bank's bank accounts in the federal funds market. So in other words, the supply of money that's lendable is going upward, and of course that pushes the interest rates, the federal funds rate, downward in those markets, like a double effect. Let me take you the other way on this. We've got a trader, we've got traders, and each one has this little portfolio of dollars, and I'm a bank president over here. I've got my tier one capital, and this time the FOMC says it's time for us to start draining liquidity from the economy. So, draining liquidity from the economy. Woman, I'm the bank president, you're the trader. You have just gotten from the desk manager that your job is to drain liquidity from the system using open market operations. I'm the bank president. I'm sitting here with my T-bills and my dollars. You're sitting at your desk with your T-bills and dollars. Now, first of all, your job is to drain liquidity. So you want to get some of my dollars away from me. But you have only one thing that you can trade for my dollars. What can you offer me for my dollars? T-bills. Okay. Ring, ring. Yeah, hello. Professor Kring, there's a desk trader. Is it that guy from last time? He was kind of cute. No, this is a lady. Okay, put her on. Well, talk to me, for God's sake. Hello, is there anyone there? Hello? What, do you have something to say? Come on. Oh, work it, girl. Come on.
We're trying to get some T-bills. I'm trying to save some T-bills.
You're trying to sell me T-bills?
No, I'm trying to get something.
So you want me to have more money? I thought we were draining money out of the economy. Take a breath. Would you like me to call you back? You know?
No.
Okay.
You're trying to buy T-bills. Can I get you some T-bills?
Oh, in other words, you're trying to sell me some T-bills. Good. You're trying to sell me some T-bills. So, in other words, what do you want me to pay you for them? Money?
Yes.
Oh, I got money, but I like my money. What are you going to offer me for a T-bill? What do you want me to buy a T-bill for? You've got T-bills. What do you want for them? How much?
$940.
Go to hell. Click. Call me back. Ring, ring. Yeah, what do you got?
$935.
The hell? $935. You want to sell me? That's not bad. Okay, you're offering me a discount. Does that come with any points for travel discounts?
No.
Go to hell. Ring, ring. Yeah.
932.
Are you even going to offer me a toaster, for God's sake? Shit. Okay, fine. She talked me into buying a T-bill. So what will happen then is she's going to send me an invoice, like, instantly. So what will happen is that I will send her money, and she will send me a T-bill, rebalancing my portfolio away from fast liquidity. So I, in order to pay her that money, I have to take money out of my bank account in the federal funds market, and all these other banks that believe her lie about the toaster being there tomorrow. And so in that case, what will happen is that the federal funds rate will pull backwards. I'm sorry, the supply curve of lendable funds, as we buy those T-bills from the Fed, the supply of lendable funds will pull backwards, so the federal funds rate will rise. Also, because now in this case, she is flooding the market with T-bills. She's pouring T-bills. All these traders are out there pouring T-bills in. So what's going to happen here is that in this case, the supply of T-bills is going to go through the roof because all these traders are dumping them out into the banks. So the price will fall on T-bills from P1 to P2. And if the price of a treasury bill falls, what happens to the rate on T-bills? Thank God Soa did, or I was going to kill myself right in front of you assholes. Yes. Okay, that's open market operations. Now, I promise you that you have to go through this in your notes, and they also do it in the book, a couple of times. If this sticks in your mind the first time and you see it clearly, you need help. It's not easy at first to see it, but it's a two-way street. Now, interestingly enough, the Fed actually, you'll see these financial news networks at the end of the day, a lot of them will have this little thing that hardly anyone knows unless you're really okay with this, Fed open market operations today, and they'll show either an up or a down, showing added liquidity or drained liquidity through open market operations, because the traders have strategies. They're not, if the desk manager tells you to drain liquidity, that would mean that you should be trying to sell T-bills to the bank every day. But that's not what you're going to do. Most days you'll sell, but some days you'll buy. Because essentially it's sort of like a valve pulling back and forth, and you don't want arbitragers and speculators figuring out what the Fed's real move is, because they'll get in front of it and play games with you on it. In other words, if I'm a trader, I'm an arbitrager, or I'm a speculator, and I know that you're going to call banks and sell them T-bills at low prices, what I might do is call bank presidents myself and get those T-bills before you can get to the bank. Offer him a 9:30, see if he'll buy. And if he offers at 9:30, then you have to call me. And I'll say 9:32, which you weren't going to go below 9:32. So I say 9:32. Well, what'd you buy it at? None of your beeswax. Do you want it at 9:32? You need it. I got myself a spread. You follow the trick? That's why the Fed can't just do the same thing over and over day after day. Now, I'm going to show you one last thing. As you know, as I told you before, I wrote for years about what was happening, trying to warn people terrible things are coming. And yeah, I was ignored, and eventually my websites were wrecked. I'm still trying to bring it back from the last catastrophe. But along the way, I had mentioned some things about the Fed and what was happening. One thing was that after about 2006, the Fed stopped creating M1 new money. The growth rate of M1 fell to almost nothing, while M2 and M3 were growing at an insane rate. The Fed, in March of 2006, stopped publishing M3 because they said no one uses it, but the real reason was it was growing so fast it was just scary. And that was largely the result of all the money that was being sent overseas as euro dollars so that we could buy stuff, imported stuff. I'm going to show you a graphic that I created and I published in mid-2008. It was shortly before the crisis. And in this last thing, I was like Chicken Little, the sky's going to fall, the sky's going to fall. Let me show you all these numbers. And of course, that's a stupid thing to do because no one wants to see all the damn numbers. But I published a graph that showed what the Fed had been doing that it was so, that was going to end up in a catastrophe. Now, I had also written about what the banks were doing with the derivatives that was going to end up in a catastrophe, but I was focusing in this one article on, in a series of articles on what the Fed had done, because I wanted to show everyone, well, you know, the M1 has collapsed to almost nothing. It's almost zero now. Though the growth rate, it's sort of bouncing around at about zero. And I also wanted to show people M3. The Fed had stopped publishing M3, but one service, Shadow Government Statistics, was still calculating it and publishing it. So I wanted to show the readers, okay, here's if the Fed were telling you the truth about M3, this is what you'd see about M3 right now. So I published this graph, and my purpose was primarily, no grab-assing. Okay, I turn off the lights. Okay, to show that I wasn't making it up. Do you see what M1 had done? Now, the money supply is supposed to grow at the real growth rate of the economy. But instead, it had gone to zero. So essentially, businesses and people were essentially being starved out. Banks were starting to take their illiquid assets and run betting schemes on them called derivatives just to generate a little quick cash through the sale of these derivatives. It was just a prescription for disaster all the way around. And as you can see it right here. You see M1 just falling apart, falling down to nothing. That was creating the liquidity crisis. And it was creating the derivatives crisis part of, well, it wasn't all of it, but it was fueling that. While M2, which actually includes M1, was growing, and M3, which they had stopped publishing, was just completely out of control. Just insane, the growth rate of it. And one speculation that I made, which probably isn't exactly correct, but my thought was, look, the Fed can't control M3. That's federal policy, that's trade policy, all that. So what it's trying to do is to take the overall and try to calm it down by zeroing out the one component they can control, which is M1, through open market operations. So I published this graph, and you know, people really kind of enjoy these graphs that I publish, because, especially now, because a lot of this, you can't find this information anywhere because the Fed has done all this stuff. And so I like to show this. Someone asked me this, well, what is it? What the hell is that spike there up and then that spike there down? And I said, oh, that was kind of a cool thing. You see, that was the 9/11 thing. Because the Fed was so concerned when the attacks happened, the people were going to run the banks, that this incredible operation across the United States with armored trucks and caravans took money to banks all over the United States, real cash money, so that the banks would have enough in case everyone ran the banks. It was an insanely complicated operation carried out by the Fed. Trucks, SWAT teams, gunships, the whole nine yards, getting money to all the banks in the country so that if people were freaking out about what happened to the towers, the banks would have the money. There wouldn't be any collapse of the banking system. And, you know, once everything had calmed down, it turned out people didn't run the banks. They were pretty cool about it. So a few months later, they drew it down. They pulled the money back out. Sent trucks, picked up the money. Except that there's one thing here. The attacks happened on September 11th, 2001. I want you to look at what was happening in the month and the 3 days, banking days, before 9/11. Do you see it? In the months and then the 3 days before 9/11. What do you see? Do you see it? Anyone? So the trucks were on the road 3 days before. Liquidity in insane levels was being added several months before. Look at it. It's right there. That was the Fed's data showing that the trucks, the money was being poured into the system several months, and in the couple of days right before the attacks, most of the money had already gotten to the banks. It's right there in the data. And I'll leave to you to decide what that means. That's all I have for you. Go home.